Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go where we want to, do what we like to do. We don't have time to get restless, there's always something new. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkey around.
And good evening, it is April 24th, 2007. You're listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name is Dana Pretzer, and we call this the Dana Pretzer Show. Tonight, we will continue in our focus on the news media, mainstream media, and have they been doing a good job lately in reporting high-profile cases. Should the Cho video have been released to the public the way that it was? How about Alec Baldwin's berating his child? Well, we're going to talk to Ken Shepard. He's the director of the Media Research Center's Newsbuster blog. He'll be here to talk about that. And then a little later on, at the bottom of the hour, Wendy Murphy. She's a former prosecutor, law professor, cable news contributor, and author of a new book. We'll be here to talk about this Kenneth Hinson trial, where Hinson got off the dungeon rapes, is what it's been called. He was convicted of raping a 12-year-old girl back in 1991, but this time he got off of raping two 17-year-old girls. It's a tragic case, and if this guy had been in jail serving his mandatory minimum sentence, this wouldn't have happened, and why did he get off this time? That's tonight here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. It's nice to have you.
Miss Mother, so like a boy,
And we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. Tonight, Ken Shepard from the Media Research Center's Newsbuster blog will be here to talk about the media and have they been doing a good job reporting these high-profile cases that we've been hearing about lately. And then Wendy Murphy a little bit later on is going to be talking about the Kenneth Hinson case. Hinson was acquitted of several charges, sex charges, when he snatched 17-year-old girls from their bedroom last year, dragged them in one at a time to the underground hidden bunker beneath a tool shed where it was alleged he raped and bound them with duct tape. Prosecutor said Hinson expected the girls to die because the room had no air supply. Hinson said that the sex was consensual. It's a sick case, and it's one that makes you wonder about what happened. Why did this guy get off? So Wendy Murphy will be here at the bottom of the hour to discuss that. While we're waiting for Ken Shepard to join us, I thought I'd open up the phone lines. I haven't done that for a little while, for about the next 5 minutes or so. You can call in and talk about anything you like at 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. You can call in and talk about anything you like. And you have to do a lot of the talking because my voice isn't quite what it should be tonight. I do remind you that our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. So if you don't get to hear the show live or you want to hear past shows, you can go there and download podcasts of past shows, listen to daily commentaries. You can listen right from the webpage. It's really neat how Tom has that set up. Just go and click play and away you go. And it goes back for quite a few shows for quite a few months. So it's very simple to do. Of course, the Scared Monkeys webpage is found at www.scaredmonkeys.com, www.scaredmonkeys.com. What I'm going to talk to Ken Shepard about is the Cho video, and should it have been released? Should this psycho have got his 15 minutes of fame? Well, more than that, that's just a saying, by having his rants replayed and have the victims re-traumatized by seeing this lunatic on mainstream media over and over and over again. And then, not as serious, but another case that has come into the forefront in the media as far as audio being released, who leaked it to the media. I think TMZ was the first place that got it, was the Baldwin audio, where Alec Baldwin takes on his 11 or 12 year old daughter. He doesn't even know how old she is, and gives her quite a tongue lashing on a voicemail. The only one that was traumatized there was the daughter, and hearing that lunatic talking to her the way that he does, and whoever released the video, you got to wonder just who has the best interests of the child at hand. But again, we'll take a couple of minutes and take your phone calls if you're interested. 1-306-842-7884. It's just a timing thing. I've got a few minutes before we bring Ken Shepard on from the Media Research Center. And you see people from the Media Research Center on all the cable news shows, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC. They're a media watchdog conservative. Yes, they are. But they monitor all media, whether it's print, radio, television, you name it, and they talk about fairness. And is the media doing a good job in what they have been doing? You know, even O'Reilly himself didn't want to show too much of the Cho video, but now tonight he has the Cho video on and has his body language expert on analyzing Cho's body language. Now, is that relevant after the fact? There should be healing going on at Virginia Tech. It's a tragedy, one that these kids, the students, the staff, faculty, whoever there will never, ever forget for the rest of their lives. I'm not sure how important it is for mainstream media or cable news to now do segments on the killer's body language, and should this have been prevented by noting his body language. Body language is important. I'm not sure what could have been done with the body language to prevent this tragedy. I just don't understand it. Maybe I'm wrong, and I'm sure I'll be criticized for what I just said, but I don't believe that that's relevant right now. We have to do what we can in the media to try and protect, try and give tips on how to protect kids in schools, older older university students, universities, middle schools, public schools, high schools, talk about safety, talk about, you know, the signs, and what to do if something like this does happen, lockdown procedures, etc. But talking about body language, right now, I think just opens up a bunch of old wounds. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back in just a minute from the Media Research Center. Ken Shepard will join us right after this.
The United States dollar took another pounding on German, French, and British exchanges this morning, hitting the lowest point ever known in West Germany. It has declined there by 41% since 1971, and this Canadian thinks it's time to speak up for the Americans as the most generous and possibly the least appreciated people in all the world. As long as 60 years ago, when I first started to read newspapers, I read of floods on the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Well, who rushed in with men and money to help? The Americans did, that's who. They have helped control floods on the Nile, the Amazon, the Ganges, and the Niger. Today, the rich bottom land of the Mississippi is underwater, and no foreign land has sent a dollar to help. Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent, Britain and Italy were lifted out of the debris of war by the Americans, who poured in billions of dollars and forgave other billions in debts. None of those countries is today paying even the interest on its remaining debts to the United States. When the franc was in danger of collapsing in 1956, it was the Americans who propped it up, and their reward was to be insulted and swindled on the streets of Paris. And I was there. I saw that. When distant cities are hit by earthquake, it's the United States that hurries in to help. Managua, Nicaragua is one of the most recent examples. So far this spring, 59 American communities have been flattened by tornadoes. Nobody has helped. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Policy, all pump billions upon billions of dollars into discouraged countries. And now newspapers in those countries are writing about the decadent, warmongering Americans. Now, I'd like to see just one of those countries that is gloating over the erosion of the United States dollar build its own airplanes. Come on now, you, let's hear it. Does any country in the world have a plane to equal the Boeing Jumbo Jet, the Lockheed TriStar, or the Douglas 10? If so, why don't they fly them? Why do all international lines except Russia fly American planes? Why does no other land on Earth even consider putting a man or a woman on the moon? You talk about Japanese technocracy and you get radios. You talk about German technocracy and you...
Okay, we're back. In our follow-up segment tonight on the tragedy at Virginia Tech and some of the media coverage, and now with the Alec Baldwin issue and the media pundits coming out saying that the audio shouldn't have been released, the audio should have been released, I thought I'd bring on Ken Shepard. He's the director of the Media Research Center's Newsbuster blog, and the Media Research Center's webpage is www.mediaresearch.org, and of course, they're America's media watchdog. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, it's been quite a week for media. For, you know, it seems like every time that you turn on the television, there's another tragedy. It's sad. It's, you know, we all sit back and say, what's this world coming to? And we focus on the victims, of course, and our thoughts and prayers go with them. We focus on the suspect or the bad guy or girl, and now we have a celebrity case where a father is berating his daughter on a voicemail, and was it leaked, wasn't it leaked? But what we haven't talked about a lot is the media, and has the media been doing a good job? Have they been living up to their standards as far as professional journalism, when they release a video of Cho, for example, when they release audio of Alec Baldwin? What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, I would think that the Cho incident and the Baldwin incident are a little bit different in this regard. The Cho incident, we've been having ourselves in-house a bit of a debate, and some of us feel that it was worthwhile, and some of us feel that it was a bit tacky or that it was inappropriate. So I think that there's a little bit more room for the media to come forward and say, you know, we did the right thing. This is news, and the video should have been played. Maybe it was overplayed at first, but it should have been played. That's more debatable. I think the Baldwin thing certainly is just a bit of a ratings ploy. certainly TMZ.com would want to get their stuff out there to a wider audience, direct more traffic to their site. And so it's not surprising that they would want to put their stuff out there, but they're not the mainstream media. They're not the ostensibly objective media. They're a niche media. And so when you look at what the cable channels were doing, certainly they had a sort of a crass, I would say, motivation in putting this stuff out there. Alec Baldwin certainly is no favorite of conservatives, and certainly he's a celebrity, so it's always kind of there's a certain bit of Schadenfreude in hitting a celebrity while he's down. You get audio like this; it's very juicy, and the tabloid instincts kick in. You kind of want to push that, but there is an obligation, I think, for the media to step back. I know that, you know, Bill O'Reilly, for example,
right,
used to put this on his program. He said that, you know, there is no reason to advance this story. It doesn't protect the child, and it unfairly brings the child into the limelight and kind of makes things a bit unfair for her. And I've seen media coverage of this saying, well, you know, this raises certain child abuse issues and all that sort of thing. And I personally think that's a bit of a defensive mechanism to say, well, no, this is an important issue, and this is really about, you know, promoting ratings. This is more about a salacious story, a water cooler story to get people to tune in, sort of like the Anna Nicole thing. There's really no news value, but you're always going to find an angle where you say, well, there is, because of child abuse or this issue and that issue and what divorce does to children. There's all kinds of angles you can take off that, but it's really kind of an afterthought. It's just like, let's get this audio up here. This is a really salacious thing. Let's talk about it.
Well, certainly a public's fascination with the Cho incident. The critics of releasing the video would say that this psychopath wanted his 15 minutes of fame. Not only did he take 32 or 33 lives while doing it, but he also got onto the TV and made all of these victims have to relive his crazy fantasy one more time. But for those that say it should be released, it's an education, and I think O'Reilly said he wanted to show the people what evil looked like. Now, I want to ask you what the public's fascination is with these high-profile type cases. Obviously, there is no comparison between Cho and Alec Baldwin. However, they are two cases where the question has come up in the media and in the public. Now, should the media do what they have done with these cases? The Baldwin girl, for example, she's a victim every time that she goes out with either one of her parents. I'm sure it's tragic, but has the media been doing a good job, or is there some ethical issues that they need to answer for?
I certainly think there may be some ethical issues to answer for. I think more so with the Baldwin case, because this is it's a celebrity gossip story, and there is an innocent party that's really being hurt in the process, and that's the daughter. With the Cho incident, what you have is a debate that I think is still raging in journalistic and conservative, liberal, whatever circles, because here what you could have done is this could have been pushed, and I think maybe what will happen in the future is you could say, okay, when you have, sadly, stories like this, there are websites for these networks. There are other ways to do this story. The story could have been, there could have been excerpts of the transcript read. Giving this killer FaceTime certainly could promote copycats. So that's the primary, I think, ethical concern, is that as journalists, you need to report the news, but you have to report it in a way that does take care of these issues, does take care of sort of glorifying that violence and promoting copycats. So that's certainly something that I think has to be looked at. In the grander scale, it could be more damaging than the Baldwin incident, but I think it's more of a tough call showing the Cho video than it is, I think, the Baldwin thing. The Baldwin thing is just something that was done to promote ratings and something to really, you know, controversy. And again, in the wake of the shootings, it's a bit of a light news story, a good light water cooler news story. But
right.
it's something that I think is a little less debatable.
Bill O'Reilly did an excellent investigation into George Soros and his influence with media organizations and personalities in particular, and the slant to the left, so to speak. Rosie O'Donnell has a huge platform with The View. Some other anchors have huge platforms with their nightly shows. Let's take a look at that just briefly here as far as your organization and how you watch media and bring media to, or take media to task as far as not being fair and balanced, to steal a term from Fox News.
Yeah, I think basically what we're trying to do is we do tape hours upon hours and have analysts plotting through this and documenting these things, both for newsbusters.org and for mrc.org, our main website, or the legacy website that we have. But what I think that we're dealing with is with other left-wing groups, they've certainly started to push back. I think the media tend to listen to them more. The media tend to give them more credence. And certainly the left are a little bit more active and actively pushing this out and saying, call these newsrooms, call these guys, call that. I think our service is more documenting the bias, putting it out there, and giving it in context of a fuller history with our archive, with our video resources and everything that we have. And ours is not so much to... for example, our mission is not so much to get people calling and burning up the phone lines or emails. Certainly folks can do that as they wish, but our goal is to sort of document this. It's a public resource, and we certainly hope that everyone reads it, from the average Joe just firing up his computer to get a critical look at the media, to we hope that it's read in the newsrooms, because we would certainly like to see the news anchors and et cetera kind of take a look at where their biases lay and kind of correcting that. But certainly I think the left has a decidedly harder edge to it. And the left was integral to the IMUS situation, where certain groups were taking the IMUS situation and really making a drumbeat out of it. We tend not to do that. We tend to simply report what's going on and push that out there. Certainly talk to the media, but I think the left has a very activist edge to it. And that's perhaps part of the reason why the media tend to listen more to the left-wing criticism. They're already getting their talking points from left-wing think tanks about tax policy, about defense, about Iraq, any number of things. So when they start to stray just a little bit toward balance, the left hit them from the left. These left-wing groups hit them from the left, and they stumble back to the left, because that's really the audience they're listening to. I don't think that the media are listening to the conservative side of the equation, even though there are plenty of conservative think tanks and experts and conservative leaders on the Hill that are always ready to talk to the media and give a conservative perspective. But the media naturally skew to the left in their personnel. They often tend to hire folks that have worked for left-wing organizations or left-wing publications, and that certainly skews the newsroom. So we certainly face a bit of an uphill struggle with that sometimes in the media.
Media has changed, obviously, in the last year, in the last 10 years, in the last 15 years. You mentioned at the start of our interview the internet being a niche type of media. I disagree with you there that the media, if anything, has, with the blogs and some of the podcasting and the news sources there, has exploded not only as a niche type, or not only as a main competition to some of these organized mainstream media outlets, but as a different voice for people to listen to. Satellite radio is another one where regulation is not there, and you can have the Howard Sterns of the world come out and spew their, in my opinion, garbage on a day-to-day basis. Where is the fine line as far as media and what the people should expect to hear, see, and read?
Well, I guess to clarify my point, it's not so much that it's a niche. I think that it's certainly at any given time, folks are going to have a certain number of websites they'll check. The mainstream media are still, in terms of raw numbers, they get a lot more attention. But quality reporting, there's certainly a lot of quality reporting, that is on the internet. And by the same token, there's a lot of quality, there's a lot of bias that's on the internet. We find a lot of things that yeah. are relegated to, like, CBS's blog, for example, where the CBS, when CBS News was covering these shootings, and they were focusing on the tragedy, they were talking to students, talking to kind of the whole mourning aspect of it. On the blogs, they were laying down the groundwork for the gun control talking points of the left.
That's true.
And now, of course, the broadcasts are taking that up again because they, as the coverage has moved away from the mourning and from the human interest angle of it to policy, they're catching up with where the blogs were putting all that content. They were getting all their talking points from the left, but they couldn't put it on TV. It was both tasteless, and it just really didn't fit with what they were going for in terms of ratings. It's not what people wanted to hear at the time. But on the blogs, you could certainly find that. So I think that there's great potential, and there's both in the future and right now, for great reporting and great media criticism on the internet. I think in terms of your question regarding, I guess, media's ethics and where it goes from here, the competition is certainly a great role to play. And I would hope that in the future, good reporting and balanced reporting on the internet will push the mainstream or the old media along those lines. But I don't personally foresee any sort of return to the sort of higher ethical standards of the past. It's just a very intense 24/7 news cycle, and the next Alec Baldwin audio tape that comes up, you know, media are going to jump on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, like I said, it's sites like TMZ and these sort of sites that that have that particular niche of celebrity
news. Yeah.
They want to get more traffic. So they go to the networks, we got this juicy audio,
yep.
book us for interviews. And of course, the networks are like, this is something that really people can sink their teeth into. To an extent, people can't sink their teeth into tax policy, Iraq, etc. Plus, after a while, these sort of things, no matter if it's biased or balanced reporting, you've got a 24/7 news cycle to fill, and you've got advertisers to please. So I think the internet in the future is going to play a good role in as people turn to it to look for balance and for good reporting. But an ethical renaissance within the newsrooms of the mainstream media, I don't see happening.
Well, you guys are doing a great job. Ken Shepard, director of MRC's Newsbuster blog, thanks for joining us this evening.
And thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. Okay. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio with Wendy Murphy.
We got to patch it up, baby, before we fall apart at the seams. We got to patch it up, baby, we came that time unravel our dream. Let's go back and touch the pen. One more night is all I ask. Get that feeling. We
baby. Sing it, Charlie. You patch it up, baby. Patch it up with a whole lot of love. Forget to patch it up, baby. Shaking going on. Yeah, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on. Yeah, we ain't faking. A whole lot of shaking going on. I said, come on over, baby. We got chickens in the barn. Born one more in my barn. Come on over, baby. We got the bull by the horn. Yeah, we ain't faking. A whole lot of shaking going on. Yeah, I said, shake, baby, shake. I said, shake, baby, shake now. I said, shake, baby, shake. I said, shake, baby, shake. We ain't faking. A whole lot of shaking going on. I said, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on. I said, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on. We ain't faking. A whole lot of shaking going on. With my mama said, shake, baby, shake. I said, shake, baby, shake now. I said, shake, baby, shake, all right. I said, shake, baby, shake. We ain't faking. A whole lot of shaking going on. Yeah. I said, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on. I said, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on.
Okay, we're back. This headline comes out of Darlington, South Carolina. A jury has acquitted a convicted sex offender of charges that he raped two teen girls in an underground bunker. Yeah, that's what it says, an underground bunker. The jury found Kenneth Glenn Hinson, 48, not guilty of kidnapping, sex crimes, and assault with intent to kill. Authorities had charged that Hinson snatched the 17-year-old girls from their bedroom last year, dragged them at one at a time, to the underground room hidden beneath a tool shed where he raped and bound them with duct tape. Prosecutors said Hinson expected the girls to die because the room had no air supply. It had been reported in the media, this case, several times. Now this dirtbag is found not guilty. This guy had been convicted of raping a 12-year-old back in 1991. I thought I'd bring on Wendy Murphy, former prosecutor, law professor, author, and cable news analyst, to discuss this shocking verdict. Wendy, how are you?
I'm well. Nice to be with you again, Dana.
What's going on here? This is something I don't think anybody expected. I'm looking at quotes from the prosecutors here. Everyone's in shock.
Yeah, I mean, shock is, I guess, even an understatement. People are so angry and surprised because it just seems to lack common sense. The gist of the defense, and in order to understand why it was so irrational, it's important to know what the defense was. This is a guy in his 40s, a rather, you know, horrible-looking guy who was a weirdo and sort of, you know, an unseemly, unlikable creature who lived near two girls who were both 17. They lived in the same region. In fact, they lived literally within steps of each other. And the theory of the defense was that they consented to him taking them into this dungeon that he built under his house, and that they consented to him tying them up and strapping them down and literally locking them in this dungeon and having forced sexual contact with them. He raped them, kidnapped them, raped them, and held them there. And the idea that a jury would believe that this is something two 17-year-olds wanted to do, and part of his claim was that, you know, it was all kind of a big orgy and they enjoyed being violated and victimized and brutalized and sort of, you know, it was all fun S&M-like activity. It's absurd on its face, but it's worse than that because this is a guy with prior conviction on his record, as you mentioned, for raping a 12-year-old child, and he served a lot of time behind bars. I think it's fair to say no one thinks he served enough time, because if he had served enough time, he wouldn't have been free to do this.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the jury never even heard that he had this prior conviction on his record. The judge excluded that from trial. And I'm not sure that that's the thing that made the big difference, but you worry when a jury goes back in to deliberate and maybe saying to itself, well, you know, if he was really a rapist, he would have done it before, and we would have heard about some other prior conviction. And since we didn't hear about some prior conviction, you know, he mustn't be the type, and so maybe this really was just a group sex thing with a couple of teenagers who had the hots for this guy because he was selling marijuana or whatever his drug thing was.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed they were lying, that they did have they were happy to have consensual sex with him, and they were lying about being raped because they wanted his drugs. There really was no evidence of that, but that was his theory. The jury, for some crazy reason, bought into it. And Dana, what this suggests to me is yet another example of what I call, and I actually have a chapter entitled this in my book that's coming out called, well, the book is called And Justice for Some, but the chapter title is called Dumb Juror Syndrome.
Exactly.
And I really think, I don't mean to laugh about this case,
no,
but I really think sometimes you just have to call it like you see it. And, you know, this was a jury of dopes. There's no other explanation for it.
4 hours. There's something terribly wrong. I know as a prosecutor or as a defense lawyer, in 4 hours you hear both sides, you probably get a pretty sick feeling when the jury comes back. Something went terribly wrong. Was this a jury selection error? Is this a dumb juror error, as you mentioned? Or is this something that we'll all sit and scratch our heads about for a long time?
Well, you know, probably all of the above. It is without a doubt a dumb juror syndrome case, and there are plenty of them. The Michael Jackson verdict, I think, is a prime example of dumb juror syndrome. And let me be clear about something, Dana. I'm not saying, you know, you're a dumb jury if you're poor or black or, you know, of any certain type of ethnicity or race or economic status. We get a lot of dopes that make a lot of money and are highly educated. Because what I say, when I use the word dumb, I mean you lack common sense. You just don't have the capacity to see the truth, and you get distracted by silliness. Very educated people can get distracted by silliness. So it's important to, when I say dumb, it's important not to hear the phrases that some people accuse me of suggesting that this has something to do with race or poverty or whatever. It isn't. And I think it goes to the heart of the most important systemic flaw that our system has right now, which is also a big piece of my book, by the way, but it's literally our failure to take the jury selection process seriously from the public's interest perspective. We do a lot of good screening when it comes to what the defense wants. If the defense wants to pick a bunch of pumpkin heads, they can do that. They can say, well, I have a constitutional right to pick a bunch of idiots, or for that matter, a bunch of people who are biased in my direction. What we don't have is any requirement that the jury be screened to make sure that they're not going to sit in judgment and believe crazy things like, well, you know, there should have been some fingerprints on the pillowcase, which, you know, is in a sense a result of the CSI effect that mm-hmm. jurors get their feelings about the way the real world works from fiction and crazy television shows and movies and the like. Or, you know, you want to be able to screen out jurors who think, well, you know, those two girls lived in a trailer park and they were poor and yeah. they smoked marijuana. And I don't even think that's true here. I'm just saying if that's the feeling a jury had, that they were biased against these kinds of victims or victims in general or women in general or, you know, poor people in general. If you feel disdain for the victim because of who they are and how they live their life, you should be excluded from the jury pool. We exclude jurors who have disdain for the accused. We don't exclude jurors who have disdain for victims, and that's a huge systemic flaw that, in my opinion, is reflected in this absurd verdict.
Ms. Hinson served 9 years in prison for raping a 12-year-old. There was a program in the state that he could have been committed into some kind of a rehabilitation program or a mental health facility, and he wasn't. Let's talk about that a little bit and mandatory minimum sentences. This guy could have been kept, and this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and I don't know how many stories we have to see like this before somebody does something something effective about the problem. But, you know, we have rules in this country in every single state that allow us to lock up dangerous sex offenders for life, if necessary, as long as we have reason to believe that they're going to commit an offense again in the future. And given the recidivism rates, you know, one study funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health in the United States, one study found that the average sex offender has 117 victims under his belt over the course of his lifetime. That's a lot, lot of harm to society, and 90% of the time that those offenses don't even get reported, so it's a lot of harm that doesn't even get disclosed, much less redressed in our justice system. And, you know, what do those victims turn out to be in terms of being injured, damaged, future offenders? It's a huge problem. So when you have a chance to lock up a guy because you know he's likely to offend again in the future and you don't do it, you know, the natural result is you're going to see more and probably more arrogant and bold and more grotesque harm, because that guy basically gets the message that it wasn't such a bad thing that he did the first time. People don't think he's dangerous, so why can't he just continue on his plight? And so, to me, the system failed society when the government brought him to the courthouse after he'd been convicted of raping a 12-year-old and said, this is a guy who is dangerous to society. He's going to rape again. He's going to rape young people again. And the judge, you know, turned a deaf ear and said, well, I don't agree. Set him free. The predictions at the time were he's going to do exactly what he did. As it turns out, the government was right, and then there's no consequence. That's
right.
Another piece of the story that is another important part of what's wrong with our system. The judge got it wrong, the system was defective, and there's no accountability. There's no punishment. There's no redress. The fact that the system got it wrong doesn't cause anybody any grief. It caused two girls to be brutalized and raped, but none of the people involved, no judge, no corrections official, nobody who made the wrong decision has to do anything to atone for it or to make up for it, and they're, you know, no one's fixing anything. And this is a guy who now is basically walking around free. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that, because he's got drug and gun charges that
right.
may well hold him, and that's a good thing. And the other good thing is, Dana, we know who he looks like. Even if he's never a registered sex offender, because of the notoriety of this case, we know who he is, we know his name, we know what he looks like, and we can be vigilant and protect our children and ourselves from who he is, because we know he's dangerous. Whether the court system thinks he's dangerous is irrelevant. We know. And so, you know, this is sort of an example of why registries aren't perfect. I don't need a registry to be worried about a particular kind of dangerous person if I already have my own access to my own base of information, and that's the good news. So chances are, as long as people are paying attention, he won't be allowed near children again, and that's a good thing. The downside is offenders who know that people are watching just go as far away as they have to find their next victims. And it's our legal system's fault. We don't think it's good for freedom. We don't think it's good for liberty. We think it's unconstitutional to lock somebody up because of the likelihood that they're going to rape another kid in the future. Oh, you know, he hasn't had his trial. He hasn't had due process. You can't lock somebody up for what they might do. The truth is, we're not talking about what he might do. We're talking about what we know he will do.
Yeah.
And that is an acceptable reason to lock somebody up. Not in prison, but maybe in some kind of commitment facility. We didn't do it. We got exactly what we bargained for when the system failed all of us. And now, not only did the justice system have a chance to lock him up forever and fail in that regard, a bunch of jurors were conspiratorial, in my opinion, with what's wrong in our legal system. And I, you know, my personal sense is that these jurors themselves should have to pay in some fashion. One of the things about Canada and other countries that I like is that when jurors really get it wrong, or when they get a verdict wrong based on racism or sexism or some other kind of hate toward the victim or toward the government or toward the prosecutor or toward the police, if you come out with the wrong result and it's an acquittal, the government can appeal.
Yep.
We don't have that. The United States doesn't allow for appeals when jurors get it wrong, when judges are corrupt, or when judges get things wrong. We need to have a big adjustment in our constitutional view of what's fair, because what's fair isn't only about what's fair to the accused. It's important to be fair to society.
Oh, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit before I let you go, Wendy, about the victim. We've seen a lot of high-profile cases here where the victim gets put on trial. Are we, as a society, preparing our victims well enough? And I know they can't be coached, but we have victim services and prosecutors and investigators and everyone that sit down and they interview the victims to get them ready for trial. In this case, it says the defense attorney picked apart the girl's stories and questioned why Hinson's fingerprints couldn't be found on the duct tape. Sounds kind of Hollywood to me. Are we doing enough to help the victims? I keep seeing the victims get put on trial, and I'm getting sick of it.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't have any problem with defense attorneys being tough in asking hard questions and exposing weak spots in the government's case, including asking tough questions of victims. What I get nervous about and what I think is unfair and really needs repair work is when it goes over the line from a tough question to a gratuitously harmful question. You know, picking apart a story is one thing. Misstating the truth, distorting the truth, gratuitously injecting into the trial process irrelevant information about a victim's past, things that really do more to cloud the issues than unveil with clarity what the real story is. Defense attorneys are increasingly getting away with that kind of sinister strategy and there's very little being done about it. One of the things I do, and there's so many good things going on, I think, at least with regard to some activists and advocates, but one of the things I do, because I've been doing this for 20 years, is I latch onto a victim as soon as I can in the aftermath of the crime, and I say, look, people are going to try to do all kinds of horrible things to you. They're going to do this. They might try this. They might try this. That is not a reason for you to back down. I don't want you to be afraid,
right.
And I'm not going to recommend that you not testify. I always urge victims to testify, and I urge prosecutors to force victims to testify, because you don't want the intimidation strategies to prevail. That's a form of corruption, if you ask me. So I teach victims several things. One is I teach them what I call their victim privacy Miranda rights. I say, you have the right. You know, defendants are always told, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. I teach victims, you have the right not to answer any probing, irrelevant question that seeks disclosure of private information that doesn't have anything to do with this case, like conversations you've had with your lawyer, your priest, your therapist, your HIV status, whether you've ever had counseling in your life, and those sorts of things that are irrelevant. But defense attorneys like to ask them. Defense investigators literally hunt victims down and hunt down friends of victims for the purpose of saying, you know, tell me some dirt about the victim. And, you know, victims will answer questions because they're trying to be honest. They believe that nobody would be asking if it wasn't important, and they don't want to hide anything. So they just blurt out all this private stuff. It becomes part of what the defense uses to make a mess of things, and you can't unring the bell once it comes out. So I teach victims to create barriers, legitimate barriers, to the gratuitous harm strategies, and it works nicely, because then if somebody asks them an improper question, they say, I don't have to answer that unless and until a judge makes me do so after a hearing, and then, you know, and so it at least puts the brakes on for a while. And victims love to be empowered with knowledge of their rights, because it helps them to feel strong. And that's one of the things thematically that I think we need to do a lot better, is to say to victims, you must report crime, you should testify, and what you need to make sure that it's not a harmful experience is knowledge of your rights, a legal support person like me for free by your side, teaching you how to advance your interests, and literally slapping the system around a little bit, or, you know, screaming at the judge or screaming at the defense attorney or screaming at the defense investigator when they're doing harm and violating innocent citizens' rights. The problem is we don't have enough lawyers in the room on behalf of victims saying, I object, you can't do that, that's unconstitutional, I'm going to file ethical charges against you if you do that, I'm going to file a lawsuit against you. I have successfully sued defense attorneys for illegal actions they've taken against victims in criminal cases. I mean, there are so many things we can be doing to stop the bad behavior. The problem is we don't have enough lawyers. Victims don't have enough money. I do mostly pro bono work. 80% of my work is free work for victims, and not a lot of people can do that. So, you know, we need more lawyers. We need more free lawyers. We need more... just more energy around the idea that victims need to be provided with an awareness of their rights and the skills and the support they need to advance them and to enforce them and to put a stop to the intimidation strategies that are successful and causing grotesque injustices.
Absolutely. Well said, as usual. Thanks, Wendy.
You bet, Dana. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in a minute.
Oh, I can't help it, I'm in love. best friend.
If you missed part of the show, it will be available later for you at scaredmonkeys.com/radio. Or if you're a regular podcast listener, that's great too. I want to thank Ken Shepherd and Wendy Murphy for dropping by the program. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Again, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live. You can listen to podcasts of past shows, my daily commentary, whatever you like. Thanks again, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
People see us everywhere. They think you really care. But myself I can't deceive. I know it's only make-believe.